Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello, and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Hugh Gustafson, a professor of anthropology and sociology at George Mason University in Virginia. His expertise is in nuclear culture, international security, and the anthropology of science. He's conducted considerable fieldwork in the United States and Russia, where he studied the culture of nuclear weapons scientists and anti-nuclear activists. He's taught in MIT's program on science, technology, and society, and he's the author of two books, including People of the Bomb, Portraits of America's Nuclear Complex, published by University of Minnesota Press in 2004. We spoke to Hugh Gustafson on this program 3 years ago, and he joins us again now on the line. Welcome to If You Love This Planet, Hugh.
It's a pleasure to be back, Helen.
Yeah. When I read your recent article in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists called An Education in Occupation, I felt an imperative drive to interview you again because it was so alarming and so devastating and just tore my heart out. So you begin by talking about as the last American soldiers left Iraq in December last year, so did many of the journalists who covered the war. That paragraph is very poignant because you point out that hardly anyone really of the journalists who covered the war have covered actually what America did in Iraq to the Iraqi people and to their institutions. So would you like first to talk about how many people do you think were killed from the first Iraqi invasion all the way through to now? What's the number you would estimate? And number two, how many refugees, both internal and external, now are the product of those two invasions? Hugh Gustafson.
You know, it's poignant to be talking about the issue of the journalists leaving Iraq today, because just yesterday, maybe the best American journalist of these Middle Eastern wars died tragically young at the age of 43. Anthony Shadid, I don't know if you or your listeners know his work, but he has a beautiful book of essays about the American occupation of Iraq called Night Draws Near. He's an Arab American. He spoke fluent Arabic, and he was one of the very few American journalists who refused to just be embedded, but who moved freely among the people. And his book is full of really heartrending stories about what life was like under the occupation. In his career, he was shot by Israeli soldiers covering the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. He was shot in the shoulder. And he was taken prisoner by Libyan soldiers covering that that struggle there and held hostage for several days. And sadly, yesterday, he snuck into Syria to cover the conflict there, and he died bizarrely of an asthma attack. So it's sad to lose one of the best mainstream American journalists. But to your question, you ask, how many refugees do I think there are? How many people dead?
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to estimate. You know, these are not easy things to count. In the article of mine that you mentioned, I say that some of the best estimates suggest that in the last decade, 30% of Iraq's middle class has fled to other countries. That's people like accountants, lawyers, doctors, professors, engineers. And these are people who probably find it more easy to move than some other people. They have resources in neighboring countries. But that's devastating for a country to lose 30% of its educated middle class. And it's one of the largest movements of refugees in the Middle East since the expulsion of Palestinians when Israel was established many decades ago. As for the numbers dead, you probably know that the American government insists on going with the numbers from an organization called Iraqi Body Count, and they've estimated something like 100,000, I guess, total dead. But they only enter someone into the ledger if their death is proved. That means if they know they were buried or if there's a record that they were brought into a hospital. And we know for sure that many Iraqis were just bodies buried by their families when they died, or the remains were never recovered. So they never got into the official statistics. The medical journal The Lancet did its own study using a much better methodology, I think, where they took maps in Iraq and they got a computer to generate, you know, random samples, and they went door to door to ask people in randomly selected places how many family members they'd lost, and then they extrapolated up from that. And the numbers get much closer to a million when you do it that way.
It just takes my breath away that America could have been so really wicked. This is my interpretation. And now I want to move on to what happened to the universities. And I'd like you, Hugh Gustafson, to describe the universities before the 1991 invasion, and why they were so good. What were the dynamics behind them being such an excellent force in the Middle East?
Well, you know, I find it ironic that the Americans and the British justified invading Iraq in 2003 by saying that they were going to bring modernity, human rights, women's rights, and so on to that country. And I think many Westerners have a stereotype that all Arabs, by definition, oppress women. They make them wear veils and so on. They're not yet modern. They're living in the Middle Ages. Iraq under Saddam Hussein, in many ways, was a deeply flawed country. You know, it was under an authoritarian regime that allowed no dissent, that locked people up, and it killed them if they criticized the regime. But in other ways, it was a quite advanced country. And it had arguably the best university system in the Middle East. So people from other countries in the Middle East, governments would pay to send their students to Iraqi universities to study because they had such a good reputation. And Saddam Hussein, especially in the earlier decades of his regime, was a secularist. He wasn't an Islamic fundamentalist. So in about 1990, the Iraqi university system had a higher proportion of female professors than Princeton University did just a few years ago. They made enormous strides towards equality for women. They educated men and women, male and female students, side by side without putting the women in veils and so on. And it was the university system that just cranked out large numbers of competent doctors and engineers, physicists, and so on, to contribute to development in Iraq. So that was the situation before 1991. They had arguably the best university system in the region.
Yeah. Well, what happened?
Well, what happened is sort of a tragedy in three acts, if you like. The first act came after the 1991 war, when the United Nations imposed sanctions on Iraq. And those sanctions bit deep into all spheres of Iraqi society, including the universities. So the universities began a precipitous decline at that point. They couldn't buy any books from abroad. They couldn't get new copies of journals. They were even, this is really bizarre, but they weren't even allowed to get sheet music from abroad. So if they ran out of Beethoven sheet music, they couldn't get any more. That was how sort of totalizing the sanctions were. They didn't have access to lab equipment, computers, and so on. So as things broke, they were not repaired. They weren't getting the most up-to-date literature. Under those circumstances, professors started to leave the universities in other countries if they could. So the university system started to decline. Then the second act in this tragedy of destruction came in 2003 with the U.S. invasion. Your listeners probably know that there was widespread looting in the days immediately after the U.S. invasion, but they may not know how badly this affected the universities. Some people in the Pentagon had warned the U.S. military that the universities were likely to be looted, and that they should be protected, but Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, chose to pay no attention to that warning. The only buildings that were protected by the U.S. military from looting were the Ministry of Oil and I think it was the Justice Ministry. But the universities were not protected. The libraries were ransacked. In many cases, really precious old documents that were hundreds of years old were burned. Libraries were burned to the ground. Whatever lab equipment there was torn out. Electrical wiring was torn out. So many of the university buildings were just gutted.
Who were the looters, Hugh?
The looters, it's hard to say. I mean, some of them were just poor Iraqis who were looking for things that they could sell on the black market or equipment that they could use in their own homes. I think some of them were Baathists who were afraid of what was in the records in the libraries, and they wanted to destroy those records. As best as I can tell, that's who the looters were. So the UN, after this, did a cost analysis. The UN and the World Bank together suggested it would cost $2 billion to rebuild the Iraqi university system. In the context of the U.S. spending over $90 billion in the first year on counterinsurgency and various kinds of rebuilding, $2 billion is not a lot. The sort of education czar who the U.S. sent over there, John Agresto, came up with his own smaller estimate. He estimated $1.2 billion to rebuild it, which really isn't very much, much less than the amount that the U.S. spent on a new laser for its nuclear weapons lab at Livermore, for example. But the U.S. Congress didn't even appropriate that $1.2 billion. They appropriated $16 million. $16 million is all they appropriated. It's a drop in the bucket. It won't even, renovate one university. So basically the message to the Iraqi universities is that they were completely on their own. And let me say something about Mr. Agresto, the person that President Bush sent to be in charge of the Iraqi university system. He spoke no Arabic at all. He had no experience in the region. The reason that he got the appointment that he got was that he was a friend of Lynn Cheney, the vice president's wife, and a friend of Donald Rumsfeld. And he'd been president of a tiny little liberal arts college in New Mexico called St. John's College that was much beloved by extreme right-wing Republicans because they taught this Western culture great books curriculum and refused to teach a multicultural curriculum. So he was picked precisely because he embodied a kind of intolerance of other cultural traditions. And he was sent to run the Iraqi university system. It would be funny if it wasn't so tragic. A journalist from the Washington Post, Rajiv Chandrasekharan, asked him when he arrived in Iraq what books he'd read in the weeks since his appointment was announced to prepare for his position in Iraq. And he said he decided to read nothing about Iraq or Islamic culture at all because he wanted an open mind. So that's the kind of person who was sent to run the system. And then the third act in this tragedy of destruction came from about 2005 to 2009 or 10, as Iraq was increasingly engulfed in sectarian fighting. That affected the universities as well. Women became afraid of coming to the universities if they weren't veiled. In many cases, they were afraid of coming at all. Anyone who spoke out in favor of tolerance of people from different traditions, anyone who was in favor of human rights, was potentially a target of assassination squads. So the exact numbers are hard to come by, but it looks as if somewhere between 170 and 300 Iraqi faculty have been assassinated, including presidents of universities, feminist professors, professors who've been trying to document assassinations of other professors. And many of the professors who lived tried to come in as little as possible because they were terrified of being killed as well, and many more of them emigrated. So the net result of all this is that in just 30 years, what had been the best university system in the Middle East is now pretty much completely destroyed. And a system that had given a good education to Arab women now hardly educates any Arab women, and the few who dare to go there are all veiled. And this was accomplished in the name of emancipating women.
Why hasn't this been documented in the New York Times and the Washington Post and the major press and you know, all the television networks, Hugh Gustafson? Why is there such a veil of silence over this wickedness?
It's a good question. The article of mine you read was originally published in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. And before it was published there, I submitted it to the New York Times Magazine.
Mm.
And they just said it wouldn't interest their readers.
Is that so?
They said they had no interest in publishing it. They didn't really give much of a reason.
How dare they?
You know, I think when you make a big mistake, it's easier to turn your back on it and move on to the next thing, right? Americans are not an enormously reflective people about the suffering they cause others. It's painful, difficult, unpleasant, inconvenient to think how badly the American errand in Iraq went wrong, to think about the American responsibility for so much pain, devastation, and suffering. It's much easier just to interminably cover the deadly dull debates between the different Republican candidates than to talk about that.
But if
you read the mainstream American newspapers, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, it is astonishing the acreage of print that they dedicate every day to Republican candidates who keep saying the same thing day after day after day.
Mm.
But it is reported as if it's news. You know, 4 pages a day sometimes of coverage of this, but hardly anything about what we did to Iraq. It's like we left under cover of darkness.
Yeah, I know, but how many killed? And there was no reason even to go into Iraq. And, you know, if you look at the history of Iraq, Saddam Hussein worked for the CIA since he was 21. So he's a CIA man. And through Hussein, America orchestrated the Iran-Iraq war, where so many young people were killed and young men, and the Kurds were destroyed with poison gas that was supplied by America, while Donald Rumsfeld was even there almost watching it at the time. I can't understand why. I mean, I read the New York Times every day to try and keep up with what's going on in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and it's important. But I can't understand how such a responsible newspaper, and it is responsible in many respects, could possibly ignore the tragedy and the killing. I mean, if one American dies, you know, in a certain situation, or a little girl's trapped in a well or something, it's all over the front pages of the New York Times and all, you know, Fox and everything else. But to have babies being torn apart by cluster bombs, you know, I can't get my mind around the fact that America, who sets itself up as being so holier than thou and sanctimonious.
Well, the New York Times has its own reason for avoiding the story.
Well,
which is,
I know that.
The New York Times distorted coverage in the run-up to the war of the weapons of mass destruction. You know, the New York Times is partly a guilty party.
It is. It's actually a major guilty party, yes, because it published 5 front-page articles by Judith Miller, who was working with Scooter Libby on the, you know, encouraging the invasion of Iraq because of weapons of mass destruction, so-called. Why?
Let me say one thing about this as an anthropologist. You know,
yes.
I think in general, it's hard work for people to look at pain they've caused others. It's hard work for people to own up to terrible mistakes that they've made. It's hard work for people, whether we're talking about individuals or whether we're talking about nations, right?
Mm.
And so there are many examples, not just of Americans, of countries who have a hard time looking at that. I mean, I could talk about how hard it's been for Australians to think about what was done to Aborigines. I'm originally English. It's been very hard for the British to own up to the terrible suffering they've caused in Ireland and in other colonies that they've had. I think in general, the countries only look that really in the face and go deeply into it when they've been completely and utterly defeated. So you think of Germany and Japan after World War II.
Mm.
But even a country like Russia, I mean, they've never really dealt with the crimes that were committed by Stalin because they haven't had to. They haven't been forced to. It's only when a system completely collapses that they have to. And you can see in so many ways that America is trying not to think about what was done under the Bush administration. There have been no trials for torture of people at Guantanamo. Obama just said, let's move on. Obama, a constitutional lawyer, who was a strong critic of Guantanamo, said, you know, let's not look too closely into what happened then. Let's just move on.
Well, why do you think Obama got captured by the Pentagon and the powers that be, that he lost his moral compass? What do you think happened to him, Hugh Gustafson?
Well, I think Obama's always been much more pragmatic than his admirers have wanted to admit, and he wants a second term. I think it might be morally great, but it would probably be politically suicidal for a first-term president to inquire too deeply into everything that was done in the previous decade in Iraq and Afghanistan and in Guantanamo, especially since the mood in America right now is of deep resentment to anyone who doesn't sing the tune of America the Beautiful all the time.
On that note, I suppose, as you're an anthropologist, and this is veering off the subject I really want to talk about, which is Iraq and the like, but the Tea Partiers. I've always thought, Hugh, that there's a strain of deep racism. How dare a black man be in the White House, let alone a black woman be the First Lady and two black children? Would you like to comment on that?
Well, you know, anthropologists are always very wary of characterizing groups they haven't studied personally. I'm wary of stereotyping them or relying on gossip. But I will say there's a political scientist at Harvard University who's recently been publishing about the Tea Party on the basis of having actually gone to lots of Tea Party meetings, read Tea Party literature, and spent time with Tea Party people. Mm. And her analysis is quite close to yours. She doesn't exactly accuse them of racism, but she says that the Tea Party represents a sort of blue-collar group and a middle-class group that feels their standard of living is enormously threatened. It's clear that they're not gaining ground economically. They're probably losing ground economically, and the recession has made that much worse. They want taxes to go down, and they in particular don't want their hard-earned money going to people who they see as unworthy. And they see immigrants above all as unworthy, and they see welfare cases, especially people of color, as being unworthy. So according to this political scientist, it's not so much focused on Obama, though I know the media have reported it that way, as that there's this resentment that their hard-earned money is going to these people who don't deserve it, people who aren't Americans because they're immigrants, or people who are believed to be lazy and not to work.
So it's kind of a displacement activity. You know, if you put rats in a cage and threaten them with a lethal situation, they tend to run away and do something irrelevant to that which threatens them. And so the real threat to these blue-collar workers, it's
Wall
not...
Wall Street bankers.
Yeah, the Wall Street bankers, which is why the Occupy movement is kind of interesting, because they have isolated the 1% in no uncertain terms, and finally the journalists are starting to cover the 1% versus the 99%, but I don't know if that's having any impact on the Tea Party as per se in their philosophy.
It seems very fluid to me. I mean, I noticed when the Occupy movement appeared that there was a surprising amount of sympathy for it in the mainstream press, especially the New York Times and the Washington Post covered the Occupy movement quite sympathetically. And it seemed as if Occupy pushed the Tea Party off the pages of the press. The Tea Party was yesterday's story, and Occupy looked interesting and new, and so there was quite a lot of coverage of it. Now, it seems to me that in the last few weeks, the press has been getting bored with Occupy as well. There isn't so much coverage of Occupy. And in a number of places around the country, the media have cleared out the Occupy encampments, sometimes quite violently. And
not the media, the police.
The police.
Yeah.
And the media have been fairly sympathetic to the police in the way they've reported that. And they've started to give prominence to stories about, you know, one or two Occupy individuals who probably aren't typical, who behave badly. I mean, in any movement like that, you're going to have people who urinate in public or smoke dope in public or get into altercations or behave strangely or whatever. And the media has a choice whether to focus on that or whether to focus on stories like the steel worker who worked hard for 40 years and lost his job and decided to pitch a tent a few blocks from Congress. And they've been giving more and more coverage to the badly behaved margins of the movement as the movement has had its encampments cleared away. So coverage of Occupy might be going into some new phase. But my sense is, and you might know better than me, my sense is that Occupy has gone into a sort of temporary hibernation for the cold months on the East Coast right now.
Yes, that's my sense.
And in the spring, they're planning to relaunch.
Yes.
In some way, and I don't think we know what that will be yet and how it will be received.
Well, they're thinking very, very deeply and philosophically about their demands and how they're going to approach the new strategy when the weather warms up a little. And I've actually interviewed one of the lawyers who's written a kind of a legal document they're going to present to the elected representatives in Congress with certain demands, which are not out of the box at all. And if those Congress people do not respond appropriately, then the next move will be after 2012 elections that Occupy, and this is pretty big, will start running their own candidates specifically against the the elected representatives who did not respond to the demands. And I think that could be quite interesting, but we'll have to wait and see. I've got another question for you, Hugh Gustafson, as an anthropologist. A question that's always really bugged me, or an issue that's bugged me, and I suppose the answer's obvious in a way, but, you know, I've been in lots of demonstrations against nuclear weapons and against nuclear power and all sorts of things, and it's always the police who support the people doing the really wicked things, like making nuclear weapons or building nuclear power plants, which are going to kill an awful lot of people in the future. But I naively, as a kind of naive, stupid girl, I suppose, or woman, I've always thought the police were there to protect me, and we pay for the police with our tax dollars. And can you sort of describe from an anthropological perspective what's happened to our societies in that now the police are armed partly by, you know, the Pentagon, now they've got extraordinary weapons that they're using against civilians and stuff to protect the 1%, if you will.
I have a colleague in my department who's former military who refers to the police as violence professionals, you know, people who are trained to use violence and force professionally, and I guess that's what they are. And to some degree, their training involves a certain amount of brainwashing, so that they're trained to set their own sentiments aside and do as they're told. They're also, I think, taught to dehumanize the people who they arrest, whether those are protesters or drug dealers or petty criminals or whoever they are. So whether they're behaving very professionally in the exercise of violence or whether they sometimes sort of channel their own inner energies and take out resentments on the people they're arresting, you know, they are trained agents of the state. Who usually operate in a fairly disciplined way to round up protesters and set their own feelings aside. Now, that said, one of the things that was interesting about the Occupy movement when it first appeared is that there were a few police who sort of broke ranks. So I know that it was well publicized that at the University of California at Davis, for example, the campus police got totally out of hand and pepper sprayed peaceful protesters who were doing nothing but sitting in a road. But at the same time, the former police commissioner of Philadelphia committed civil disobedience and was arrested by his own police for committing civil disobedience in sympathy with the Occupy protesters. And there were a few other lower-profile police who did similar things. So it's not impossible that you could get some sort of crack in the unity of law enforcement, which, of course, is the one thing that the state most dreads. If the state loses control of the police, then they're deeply, deeply in trouble. The philosopher of nonviolence, Gene Sharp, whose work you may know,
yes,
he was an inspiration for the Serbs, who managed to finally get rid of the Milosevic regime in the 1990s, and he was an inspiration for Eastern Europeans protesting their governments in the late 1980s. He argues that you should never demonize the police, never treat them as the enemy, because if you treat them that way, then they will respond that way.
Mm.
So I guess it's a lesson that we saw with Martin Luther King. You treat the police with respect, and you try to get them to respond to you as human beings who might potentially be allies. How feasible that is, I don't know. We'll see.
Yes, make friends with them. So that leads me on to another subject that's fascinating me and that I need to investigate further. But as an anthropologist, Hugh Gustafson, you talked about the police being trained and they're in a way dehumanized, or they dehumanize the people they're going to arrest. What absolutely fascinates me, and I need to get some manuals and read them, how the Pentagon trains young men to become killers and to remove their humanity. And I think it was really beautifully illustrated in the film Heavy Metal Jacket, where they were training these men to kill, and one young man who was not terribly bright, who had a lower IQ than the others, just lost the plot and became irrational and killed his superiors. Has there been anthropological work done on how you train people to become killers, Hugh?
I don't know about anthropological. There's a famous book by Grossman called On Killing. I believe he's a political psychologist.
I
think it's clear that the more distant the killer is from the killed, the easier it is to kill them. So it's much easier to kill someone with a rifle than with a sword. It's easier still to kill them from 25,000 feet by dropping a bomb from a B-52 than to do it through a rifle sight. And probably it's easier still to do it by drone.
Yes.
If you're in McLean, Virginia, and your victim's in Pakistan. So distance has something to do with it. If you are going to be proximate to the person you're killing, dehumanizing them is important. So you call them gooks, or you call them ragheads, or towelheads. You disparage them, see them as culturally inferior, as lacking in individuality, lacking in distinct individual human worth. But then I think group solidarity of the soldiers is really important. Whether you're talking about a policeman arresting Occupy protesters or a soldier in Afghanistan fighting against the Taliban, I think it's really important that you don't want to lose face with your comrades. And a lot of what fighting is about is the intimacy between small groups of men with each other, a kind of homoerotic intimacy, I would argue. And what people most dread, and what they dread probably more than death in many cases, is losing the love of their comrades, losing that intense fellowship of being part of a band of brothers, as Shakespeare called it in Henry V, right? That solidarity, often a masculine solidarity, is what's really, really important. And to go back to Full Metal Jacket, which is a film I love, and I show it every year in my class on the anthropology of war, what you see there is the terror of losing the intimacy of a group and the terror of losing masculinity, so that the drill sergeant denigrates men who aren't up to it by likening them obscenely to women or parts of the female anatomy, or likening them to homos and fags and so on. And it is actually a very interesting question for the U.S. military now that in the last few months they've said that gays and lesbians can openly serve. Well, how do you socialize people in Marine Corps basic training if you can't denigrate them as queers anymore? And you can't really denigrate them as women either, because women are now part of the U.S. military. And just last week, the U.S. military opened up new combat roles for women. But you have to have some outgroup that you denigrate, and you warn people that they will become part of that outgroup if they don't perform well. So there's a kind of cultural challenge for the military that I don't know how they're going to solve. By the way, in terms of Full Metal Jacket, I may no longer be able to show it. There's a legislator in Arizona who's trying to get a law passed right now that any professor who in their lecture uses any obscene word or has any obscene material in class will be suspended without pay.
How disgusting.
So if I were to show Full Metal Jacket, it has the F word so much, I'd probably be suspended for a semester.
Oh, my God, Hugh. Yes, see, what really gets me about the military is the denigration of women, and being one myself, it just absolutely freaks me out. And, you know, it was Gloria Steinem who introduced the notion that women should join the military under the Equal Rights Amendment or whatever she was doing. And I knew right then that that was a really bad thing, because I knew how they condition men to kill. And one of the main things that you just pointed out is to denigrate women and their sexuality and even their anatomy, you know, their vaginas and the whole thing. I mean, it's really disgusting. And so now women are in the military. What is it? 30% of them get raped, or they get... And it's inevitable. If you train men to kill by denigrating women and calling the men faggots and all of that sort of stuff, of course they're going to rape women and conduct terrible things, you know, do terrible things to women, because that's how they've been conditioned. Would you like to comment on that? I mean, it's a really terrible situation.
Well, what struck me in your question is the role of Gloria Steinem and a particular kind of feminist in this. When I started to track these issues in the early 80s, it was assumed within the women's movement that part of being a feminist was being anti-military. These were the years of the women's peace encampment at Greenham Common in the U.S., women's only peace encampments in Seneca in New York and other places. The anti-nuclear movement in many countries was led by strong feminist women, including yourself. And it was assumed that there was a strong and inevitable inherent connection between feminism and the struggle against militarism. We seem to have lost that, and the women's movement seems to have lost that, so that now the expression of feminism in regard to military affairs is to argue that women have a right to shoot people on the front line too. Women also have a right to run an aircraft carrier. Women also have a right to be fighter pilots. So that we have what I've called feminist militarism at this point, rather than feminist pacifism.
Yeah, but you didn't, I agree with that, but you didn't discuss the point I made where, you know, having women in the military, where the military, the men are trained to hate women and denigrate them, leads inevitably to abuse of women physically and mentally when they join the military.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And it's not just the denigration of women. I mean, if you imagine the situation of young, testosterone-laden men, they're away from their wives and girlfriends who've been left on the other side of the world. They're in an extremely stressful situation if they're in Afghanistan, say, where they don't know if they will be alive the next day or if they'll have a traumatic brain injury from going out on patrol the next day. So it's an extremely stressful situation where there's a sort of natural, understandable urge to satisfy cravings for experience and intimacy before you die. And the only women around with whom to act out sexual urges, you can't do it with the local women in a place like Afghanistan. The only women available are other U.S. military women. And you may have gone through basic training that's taught you to denigrate them in some way. So, I mean, I think the incidence of male and female rape in the U.S. military is among the highest in any sector of American society, probably the highest.
Yeah.
And that's why.
Yeah. Now, here's the next question. It's a question I used to ask my father when I was a young girl. But, Daddy, why do men rape women when they conquer a territory? The women have done nothing. They're innocent. Why do they rape the women? And my beloved father couldn't answer the question. Do you have an answer for that as an anthropologist, Hugh Gustafson?
I should preface this by saying that I've not heard any evidence that U.S. military soldiers raped local women in Iraq or in Afghanistan. So
I didn't. I really wasn't asking that about
right.
American
so
soldiers.
I just want to emphasize. So I don't think we've been talking about those wars a lot in this conversation.
Yeah.
And so any answer I give to this isn't about those particular wars.
Right.
But I think it has to do with a kind of collective psychological decompression at the moment of victory. You know, there's this intense ecstasy that you lived when the war is over. And you're in a situation outside the normal cultural rules. You're not in your home country. You're not around your family or the people you usually work with and so on. You're in this sort of space outside of normal space. what anthropologists call a liminal situation where the rules don't apply. And it's a situation where you are coming out of this intense emotional experience marked by physical and emotional exhaustion, wondering if you're going to die, watching close buddies being blown apart and so on. And so people act out in a situation like that. And one of the ways they act out is by destroying things, killing people who are in the way wantonly, destroying property. And another way that they act out is by taking physical gratification from whatever women they find. You know, Freud had the insight that the impulse of love and desire, eros, and the impulse of destruction, destruto, are very closely linked. They sort of exchange energy with one another. And I think you see that intense binding of those two energies at that moment, at the climax of war, if I can use that term.
Well, it's a very interesting book describing male behavior called The Male Brain, written by a biologist who is in San Francisco, and I can't remember her name at the moment.
Is it Simon LaVey?
No, it's a woman.
Okay.
And she describes, and this is recent work done on neurophysiology, that in the midbrain, the two emotions that trigger the release of the hormone, which and I can't remember the name of the hormone, it'll come to me as I talk, I think, the hormone that provides intense feelings of joy and ecstasy, the two instincts are sex and violence, and they're associated together within the male midbrain. And
what about drugs? What about drug use?
Yeah, well, it induces a drug-like feeling, you know, that sort of opioid feeling that you get by taking opium, this feeling that you get when you have sex, the release of I can't think of the name of it.
Is it serotonin?
Serotonin? No, it's not serotonin. It's another one.
Dopamine.
Dopamine. The release of dopamine comes with sex and orgasm, and also with violence. And so sex and violence within the male brain are very intimately connected. And then, so I extrapolated from that to say, ask myself, why do they show porno films to men who take off from aircraft carriers and go to bomb and kill people? Why do men ejaculate when they go into battle? What is the connection between sex and violence? And it's really clear in the way the Pentagon trains killers, men to be killers, that sex and violence go hand in hand. And we were just discussing that as you talked about men feeling relieved and they go into a conquered territory and rape the women, which really is violence and it's sex.
I'm not a neurophysiologist, but I would wonder whether that's only males, because I remember reading an interview many years ago with a U.S. female pilot who was shot down in 1991 in the first Iraq War, and she talked about how she loved flying in combat, and she said, and I still remember this quote, that it was the most exciting thing in her life next to sex. And she made a comparison between the two.
Fancy that.
So I mean, that same conjuncture was very real for her.
Well, I'd say that she probably had an arenoblastoma on her ovary, which secreted testosterone. No, I'm being facetious, Hugh. That's a testosterone-secreting, androgen-secreting tumour that can grow on female ovaries occasionally. I want to just move on.
But this does raise an interesting question of how women get sexed up for war, right? I mean, now the U.S. has decided to move women much more into combat roles.
Yeah, yeah.
So what would we expect women to do in future wars?
I don't know, because
they're in the front line overrunning civilians.
All our hormones are related to nurturing, you know, estrogen, progesterone, and particularly oxytocin. And so
but I would ask you about Abu Ghraib, because the pictures from Abu Ghraib show young female guards clearly getting an enormous sexual charge from sexual denigration and humiliation of Iraqi men.
Well, was it a sexual charge?
It suggests that once you move women into the military, you can get women to behave the way men have behaved, with this sort of mixture of sadism, violence, and sexuality.
Well, I would question whether it was a sexual charge. I know that the young woman that they jailed for having that pile of bodies there and you know, having the dogs and the revolting stuff, she was in love with one of the officers, and she did it to please him. And I would question maybe whether she was getting a sexual charge or not from that. The other paper that you sent me, Hugh, and we're not going to have much time to discuss it, is called The Assault on Los Alamos National Laboratory, A Drama in Three Acts. And it really interested me because I know that you wrote about the Los Alamos lab scientists and you spent about a year with them as an anthropologist getting to understand them and how they had the impetus to make bombs that could destroy life on the planet, let alone, you know, kill millions of people in one unholy blast, and how they talked about designing the bombs and how they talked about giving birth to the bomb. And before the bomb was tested, they said they had labor pains, and after the bomb blew up in the desert, you know, they got postnatal depression, and all of that sort of stuff absolutely fascinated me. And obviously you made close friends with these scientists as you studied their behavior and their motivations. You've now written this article for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which is fascinating because I see in your writing a deep sympathy and empathy with these scientists who've been denigrated by all sorts of congresspeople and by the Department of Energy, and they're called long hairs and they're too bright and they're not responsible enough with the secrets of the bombs, and now they've put Bechtel, which is a revolting company, in charge of the labs instead of the University of California Regents, which ran the labs previously, and how these scientists, their morale is so low. And I have a feeling during this paper that you wrote, Hugh Gustafson, that you're empathizing with these men who are the designers and women. And women, yeah, okay, women, there are a few women, women who are the designers of weapons of the ultimate mass destruction.
Yeah. It's a complicated relationship I have with them.
Mm.
I mean, I would never take the job that they have.
Mm.
I would not feel comfortable doing it, but you're right that over the 2 years that I spent doing my fieldwork, I became friends with them. They were weapons scientists at my wedding. I went to church with them. I lived in houses with them. Ate dinner with them much of the time, and so on. So, you know, I know them as people who, in some cases, I have respect for, and in some cases, I don't. I think what annoys me about the current situation is that they're being scapegoated unfairly. It would be one thing if Congress said, look, nuclear weapons serve their role, but the Cold War is over. We'd like to say thank you to the weapons scientists and lay half of them off because we don't need them anymore.
Mm.
That would be fair. But instead, they're being scapegoated for things that they haven't done. And it sort of violates my sense of basic fairness. You don't accuse people of things they haven't done and then punish them for it. In this case, they're being accused of mishandling secrets when, for the most part, they haven't. In some ways, I see my own situation in theirs. In recent years, they've been subjected to enormous bureaucratic micromanagement. They can barely buy a pipette without filling out five forms, you know. And anyone who teaches at an American university will tell you that this is what our lives are like now.
Really?
But you can't buy a stapler from this vendor. You can only go to the state-approved vendor and so on. And so in some ways, it's sort of a story told through the weapons labs, but it's a story about many, many people in America who are micromanaged by people above them in ways that are completely irrational and that stop them from being productive and creative in their work, really.
Are you being obstructed in the very, very interesting anthropological work and research that you're currently involved in, Hugh Gustafson?
Well, I'm finishing up a book about the weapons labs since the Cold War.
Yeah.
And I do wonder, since I published that article that you just mentioned, whether people at the labs won't talk to me anymore, or at least managers won't. When that article came out, my email inbox was full to overflowing with messages from rank-and-file weapons scientists, some of them saying, you know, I read some of your previous work and I didn't like it very much, but I just wanted to really thank you for standing up for us and telling the truth about the way we're being scapegoated and mistreated. But managers at the labs were very, very unhappy that I'd written this article, and people warned me not to email them on their lab email accounts, that they were being watched to see if they spoke to me and things like that, and that lab management was trying to find out what my sources were for the article. So it's possible that it may be hard from here on for me to talk to people at the labs unless I talk to them, out of sight, so to speak.
It's very interesting now, though, in the last 2 days, Hugh, there have been some indications that Obama is moving towards a real reduction in nuclear weapons in America from the current 1,700 weapons on hair trigger alert, actually, down to 300 to 400, which is still...
I'm very skeptical.
Pardon?
I'm very skeptical.
You're skeptical?
I mean, it would be great if he would go to do it, but I really don't believe he's seriously considering it. I don't think that a president campaigning for re-election in an election year would do something like that, that would leave him open to the charge of endangering national security. I can imagine him doing it in a second term, but not right now. So I think one of two things has happened. I mean, the stories you've read came from leaks, and I've heard a number of people suggest that actually the leaks were from people on the right wing of this debate, trying to make sure that it would get into the public sphere and Obama couldn't make any cuts. Or it may be that the stories are suggesting much deeper cuts than would really take place, so that if he cuts 200, it won't look like so much.
Yeah.
I may live to eat my words, but I would be very surprised if in an election year he made a decision to take the U.S. nuclear stockpile down to not much more than the size of China's.
But also they've decided to defund the lab that was to be built at Los Alamos to make new plutonium pits.
That's right.
And that was going to cost about $7 billion. And they are defunding, where's the other place? Not Tennessee.
The Oak Ridge place.
The Oak Ridge, yeah.
In Tennessee, yeah.
Yeah. They're defunding the new labs that are keen to build new nuclear weapons parts and new nuclear weapons because of the budget crisis.
Mm-hmm. I think to talk about it at a more sort of deep structural level, since 1945, as the military-industrial complex grew in strength, American political economy was fundamentally underpinned by this alliance between the military sector and banking capital and industrial capital.
Mm.
And that sort of broadly conservative alliance supported various kinds of industrial elites and channeled money to the military-industrial sector. Now, right-wing politicians, to get elected, have attacked the federal budget, and you cannot get elected in America if you talk about increasing taxes. So all the talk is about cutting the budget. And I think they've created a dynamic that threatens to drive a wedge right down the middle of that alliance that for the last six decades has powered America. Because it's really hard to cut the budget if you don't start cutting military things.
Yeah.
And so you see talk of one less aircraft carrier. You see talk of canceling the Joint Strike Fighter. Now there's this decision which may or may not last in the long run to cancel the plutonium facility at Los Alamos, but they're all symptomatic of the possibility that this alliance may get broken apart. You could think of it as an alliance between Wall Street and the Pentagon, if you like.
Well, on that note, Hugh, we've run out of time. I could talk to you easily for another hour. It's absolutely fascinating. but we'll do a repeat in the future, and I thank you so much for your insights and your anthropological analyses of all these major issues, which I think is so important, because unless we get to the etiology of war and killing and what's wrong with society, in other words, the psychological causes, we're never going to fix anything. Would you agree?
I would, and as always, Helen, it's a real pleasure to talk to you.
And thank you very much, Hugh. Today on If You Love This Planet, I've been speaking with Hugh Gustafson, a professor of anthropology and sociology at George Mason University in Virginia. Thanks for listening yet again, and we'll be back with you next week with another absolutely fascinating program. Talk to you then. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.